Recorded on location at Aspen Ideas Health in Aspen, Colorado.
If you've learned anything about the most recent research on obesity, diabetes, or cardiovascular disease, you've probably read it in the Journal of the American Medical Association. They're celebrating their 141st anniversary.
I think about what JAMA and the JAMA Network has to do right now is do the core functions the same way we've always done it, vetting the science, making sure this is science you can trust, putting the stamp of approval in that way on it, and then publishing it. And then we have to do something that I think all journals need to do better, and certainly we do, and that is being a modern communication vehicle.
Our guest today is Dr. Kirsten Bivens-Domingo, the editor-in-chief of JAMA and the JAMA Network. She's also a renowned physician, scientist at the University of California at San Francisco, and she's the first person of color and only the second woman to lead the journal.
I am not the keeper of trust for the journal. I'm not the keeper of our focus on equity. In fact, the journal and our sets of journals have always put equity at the forefront of how we have thought about this. But my goal was to put more processes in place so that we could collectively have those conversations, be more transparent about them.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Dr. Kirsten Bivens-Domingo, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me, and please call me Kirsten.
Kirsten, oh, that's great. And we find ourselves in this beautiful space here in Aspen Ideas Health, and I know you have a session coming up, and I'm kind of interested about trust.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm wondering if people are stopping to believe in science, and that's maybe a driver of why this conversation is happening. Tell us more about the session today and some of the thoughts that you are bringing.
Yeah, I think it's a big issue for us. If you think about as physicians, as clinicians, we know that that your healthcare professional is the person that is the most trusted mm-hmm. as the source of healthcare information. But we also know that when you survey the public, people are wildly mistrustful of institutions, mm-hmm. of some of that is within a political context. But also, you know, it's like just because it was published, you know, do we really believe it? And there's a lot of that type of questioning going on. It's an issue for us who are in healthcare. It's an issue for us as scientists. It's an issue for us as a journal, because we are only as good as people trust both our authors and our readers in what we publish. And so I think we have to actively engage in this issue of the growing rise of mistrust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have to say that I was surprised, I don't know why, in a recent poll that this is true kind of across the political divides. It's true among Democrats and it's true among Republicans. And it's my sense, you can tell me if I'm accurate or not, that your journal is quite accessible and probably a wide range of people, clinicians, non-clinicians, interested people are reading it. Is there a specific role that the journal can play in helping to elevate this belief both in scientists and science, I guess?
Yeah, thanks for saying it that way, because I think that we tend to think of this as the people on the other side of the political divide from
right.
us, and
right.
that's not really
right.
the case. I think there is a bit of an erosion of trust in professionals, in experts. And so I think what a journal has to do, a journal is really, we are publishing for scientists, we're publishing for clinicians, for health policy leaders, for the lay public, we're a global journal.
Right.
So we're always publishing to multiple people who might have different perspectives. My personal view on this is our goal is to broaden the conversation, to bring more people in, not to say, to be finger wagging and
right.
say, this is the right answer
right.
and now you've got to believe it. But we believe very strongly that science is the foundation of providing the evidence for what we know works in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
we believe strongly in. But the conversations of how to draw people into that, that is where we can use a variety of techniques.
Mm-hmm.
We can use a variety of ways of communicating about the science, a
right.
variety of ways of talking about the nuance, using a variety of modes of communication.
Right.
And we have to do that to bring more
right.
people in.
Speaking of bringing more people in, you say journal, I say JAMA.
Thank you. I love that.
I think it's such a powerful name. But maybe take us behind the scenes, behind the curtain. 13 journals, the relationship with the AMA. How does that all work? What should our listeners understand about what goes on behind the scenes?
Sure. So thank you. So we're 13 journals strong. JAMA, the flagship journal, 141 years old, a general medical journal, one of the top journals in the world. 13 journals, that includes 11 subspecialty journals that are each led by their own academic editor, and a big open access journal of JAMA Network Open. We are each in our categories amongst the leaders in those categories, so sought after by both authors and readers. And we're a network of journals that wants to work together to be sort of the best platform for communicating the science that affects health. So the thing that I, so when I started, and I've been in this job 2 years, when I started, I found a remarkably strong organization, really energized and deeply committed to the science and to the science that improves health. I think about what JAMA and the JAMA Network has to do right now is do the core functions the same way we've always done it, vetting the science, making sure this is science you can trust, putting the stamp of approval in that way on it, and then publishing it. And then we have to do something that I think all journals need to do better, and certainly we do, and that is being a modern communication vehicle, sort of thinking about all the ways we communicate. We are all overloaded with information.
That's right.
We are all looking at our phones for information. We are all getting ads and things like telling us what we should believe and what we should think. We have to be in that space. We have to use videos and podcasts and images. We have to use social platforms. We have to think about how we use that technology to help you to find what exactly you want to read and you to find what you want to read, and then have the ability to discover something new that you might not have known you should read, but we should help you to find that as well. And that modern, being a communication platform in a modern era, is what journals have to get better at. And it's what we're relentlessly focused on.
All right, getting modern. I'm going to ask what my kids are asking. Are you on TikTok?
Well, I have to say, I personally am on TikTok.
All right.
And that was the experiment to see whether JAMA should be on TikTok. So stay tuned.
Okay.
You know, we are obviously, TikTok is one of those platforms that's being bandied about in the political arena.
That's right.
So, but I think
but
we
it's
have
what people
to,
are, young people are.
If you ask, I have a good a young colleague who is, you know, just finished in public health school. She says she shows me the videos that she watches, people are using shorter forms of communicating and platforms for communicating. And lest we say this is all an age issue, I have one of my most cherished board members tell me, he's like, your abstracts are too long. Everything is too long.
That's
it
right.
needs
yeah.
to be shorter. Yeah. We need to get to the bottom line faster. And I think that reflects the space all of us live in.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, you know, there's few things that stay with you over the course of a long career is kind of a brand, or a, you know, a trusted brand, I would say. And if you're a clinician, as I am, that JAMA is one of those. So that's really important. But it's also important there constantly be fresh and new material. And you recently remarked that you were invigorated by reading some of the articles that you're publishing in the journal, from artificial intelligence to something maybe very provocative, like the future of clinical trials. So maybe share with us just a couple of your best picks or favorite articles that really gave you energy reading them as they went to press.
Sure. So first of all, there's really an explosion of science. I mean, what you can see here at this festival here is just the discovery science. It's really pushing the boundaries on new therapeutics for Alzheimer's disease and tackling obesity and things like that. And so that is an exciting time for discovery. Our goal as a clinical journal is to be at the forefront of publishing those, but also to put it in context, because things are complicated. We don't exactly know how to use all of these medicines in which patients they will work the best. how we're going to pay for them,
yeah.
how we're going to figure out how they really impact the conversations we have in clinical practice. But they're so exciting. And
yeah.
you can't help but yeah. be excited by what our basic science colleagues are really helping us to bring to the forefront. I think AI is one of those things that is a little daunting. One of the things that I launched about a year ago is just conversations with leaders about AI. Again, the goal was to bring more people into the discussion because there is no doubt that AI will transform how we practice medicine,
yep.
how we conduct science, and how we publish.
Yeah.
And we have to all understand that so that we can get the best out of it
right.
and also figure out where the guardrails
right.
should be.
Right.
So I'm excited about that. We launched a communication series at JAMA because we thought in this era of mistrust, where we know the frontline clinician is the person that patients trust,
mm-hmm.
We want clinicians to be as good as they possibly
right.
can.
And that's a science too, which
exactly.
I don't think most people realize.
exactly.
Yeah.
And so we worked with communication scientists to bring their approach to how we think about having the conversations in healthcare. Because we know in the one-on-one encounter, you know this, that we know that you can talk about nuance. You can talk with people who have a different point of view than you. And so giving clinicians more tools in this environment to have
yeah.
hard conversations
yeah.
is also, I think, just as important.
Yeah. Very, very exciting. I can see why you're invigorated. Those letters to the editor will tell you what people are invigorated about
oh, yes.
that are reading your articles.
Oh, yes.
Well, let me connect the dots between mistrust in clinicians. You're a general internist, a cardiovascular researcher, an epidemiologist, and you were brought on to the journal a couple of years ago to really restore trust. There had been a serious breakdown within that, and you started to talk about some of the things you're doing, but maybe expand a little on that. I think the reasons you were brought in were very serious, concerned about the impact that racism has in medicine. And this is something our audience is very concerned about, and I know you are as well.
Yeah, I think JAMA had a very public incident in 2021. I think JAMA had a public incident, and that uncovered what is true across healthcare,
exactly.
Across medicine, and certainly true in medical publishing.
That's right.
And so I think that it was an important time. It was an important time when all of us were having conversations about race, about inequity, about inequality, about and how we as institutions can be worthy of the trust that mm-hmm. we hope others will place in us. And so for me, I think it was an interesting time to come on to a journal. My view on this is that I am not the keeper of trust for the journal. I'm not the keeper of our focus on equity. In fact, the journal and our sets of journals have always put equity at the forefront of how we have thought about this. But my goal was to put more processes in place so that we could collectively have those conversations, be more transparent about them, think about the processes that help us make sure we're always trying to be the best we can be, make sure that all people in our organization have voice so that they can say, well, yeah, that we don't think is exactly the right way to approach it, that we can be more transparent with our readers and our authors so that they also can take part in the conversation. We are not always going to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But we, as a communications platform, we always have to be a place where people say, I don't really like that, but I trust that they are working to making sure that different voices are heard in this. And that's what we have
and
to do.
And
be.
I think it's so important. We have within our organization, somebody leads up justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. And we remind everybody, it's not one person.
Right.
It's not. It's got to be all of us.
It's
and
not.
Sort of that inclusive message is so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, among the many things that you're known for, you're known as a leader in prevention and in addressing health inequities, as we were just talking about some of those issues. And I think it was about 2 years ago that you remarked that you thought in many communities the gulf was getting wider,
yeah.
not closing. And, you know, this is particularly concerning. We're years past the ACA and,
yeah.
you know, so many things
yeah.
that should have been closing the gap, not widening it. What are the strategies on your mind these days to make more progress in that area?
Yeah, I think we obviously saw it during the pandemic. The pandemic exposed a lot of the pre-existing health inequities. I think it is the thing that concerns me. The pandemic was one of the reasons I got energized to be part of journals thinking about the communications in this space. I think that concerns me a little bit as we also have a little bit of fatigue on these issues. We quickly snap back to saying, okay, well, we know they're out there, but we have other things we've got to move on to. And I see the gulf is widening. There's no doubt about it.
There's no doubt
about it. And it's widening to the point that when you look at the statistics of what we think makes the U.S. strong, you see across so many different factors, increasing mortality in children. You see, you still see the high maternal mortality rates. You see a shortening of the life expectancy, and you see all of those disproportionately affected in poor and minoritized communities. And so, those numbers are what the U.S. puts forward and makes us. We're not anywhere close to our peer countries at this point. And so, we have to have those conversations. We have to have those conversations as a country, but also it starts very locally. What we see is that both the gaps are very different by location, but also the solutions happen on a very local level.
Right.
And that's what I want us to be able to give more voice to, of where, not just the big problem, which we all have to deal with, but also where are those areas where people really have tackled this issue for a sustained period of time, and there is evidence
and systems in which that has happened, which gives us a bigger bang for the buck.
Exactly right.
You know, one of the areas that we're very concerned about is primary care, and we've seen really a retreat in terms of the resources that are being spent. Want to sort of ask, why isn't there a journal on primary care that you have a lot of journals, but primary care is missing. And I think that's a real problem, because we've moved people away from the relationship with a primary care clinician to a specialist. We need great specialists, but at the same time, there's a real assault on primary care. What voice are you trying to give to that topic?
Yeah, well, as a primary care provider myself, I totally agree with you. I think primary care was particularly hard hit during the pandemic. I think when we hear talks about burnout amongst clinicians, we hear that's a lot in primary care. We know people are leaving this field. It's been true before the pandemic, but the pandemic certainly didn't help. I think we at JAMA, I think, have published quite a bit on the policy issues that relate to this. I think if you look at our journal, JAMA Internal Medicine, it isn't a primary care journal, but I will say that the editors of JAMA Internal Medicine are all very active primary care clinicians. And so if you look at how they publish, what they publish, their focus, it is much of the primary care. And what we want to do is take our top journals. There's always a tendency to think that we need the Journal of Primary Care, which one could argue that might be a better journal to give voice to that. JAMA and JAMA Internal Medicine are really our top and most widely circulated and read journals. They're journals where the editors have a strong interest in primary care, and I think you see that in the content that's there. I want to make sure that the primary care providers can and clinicians can find that content if they're only looking in primary care. But I do think we have to publish both on the policy issues as well as on the sort of the issues that are taking place in practice so that we can continue to be a voice on these issues.
Wonderful.
Well, your host institution, the University of California at San Francisco, certainly has created much of the research in primary care that has guided those of us in the field, particularly in community health centers. So we know you come from that very, very strong and noble background. But
exactly.
I want to do a bit of a shift to something that I had not realized until recently was as much of a problem as it apparently is, and that's the amount of research that's being done and published on that cannot be recreated, what some call useless research. I had not heard this until recently. We spend close to $30 billion, I think $26 billion a year on research, and a lot of it just can't be reduced, which by definition, except for qualitative studies sometimes, by definition would make you think it wasn't really solid, valid research. What are your thoughts on that? And what's the screen as you're thinking about publishing and accepting articles?
Yeah, that's so. I think the NIH has called it the reproducibility crisis, right? So that, you know, you want science to be published and hopefully someone else can reproduce it. That's right. How we have more confidence in
right.
it. And over, I think, the last, at least the last decade, but probably longer, there's been a growing awareness led by certain fields where the reproducibility crisis is particularly stark, that there's lots of studies that are funded, there are lots of studies that are published, that when we look deeper, really can't be reproduced. Now, on the one hand, you could say, well, that's part of science, right? So, you know, you publish and then you put it out there and somebody else should try to reproduce
getting
it.
Getting different results is different than not being able to do it.
100%. That's what we're talking about. Yeah. And when you have entire fields, you know, there are certain branches in psychiatry, for example, where you have entire fields where you're like, well, the most prominent people have results of their experiments that can't be reproduced. So this is a problem. Huh. What you see in those fields is that they have taken it on themselves to basically understand how can scientists say ahead of time what question they were really trying to answer? How can we make our data more available to others ahead mm-hmm. of time so that we can see, because some of these things are very obvious
right.
that the data
right.
is you know, it is unlikely to be reproducible.
Uh-huh.
And I think you see this move towards openness, transparency for registering questions ahead of time. So we know what you intended to ask, not what you, as you got closer down the road,
right.
like decided you just wanted
Very
to focus
good point.
On. And I think journals play a role in helping to create the opportunities to document those things about registration, about your ability to share data and those things.
Yeah.
I will say we have to be even better at this.
Yeah.
And we have to be better with other sectors of the biomedical ecosystem. Journals can't do it alone.
Right.
Academic institutions have to play a
right.
part. The funders have to play a part. And then
NIH.
Each field has
yeah.
to play a part.
Mm-hmm.
I do worry that during that, you know, this wonderful power of AI just makes the ability to you know, sort of shift things a little bit or commit out and out fraud easier. It's not good, you know, fraud was there forever, but AI allows you to scale things and to do that in a way that is just so much easier.
Yeah.
And so it means all of us have to be better at what
yeah.
we're doing, and we all have to take it
yeah.
more seriously, because we started with this issue of
trust. I was just
and
thinking
we
that
cannot
100%.
We cannot be starting
yeah.
with like
yeah.
well, I don't really trust this. We
right.
cannot be
right.
there. I think JAMA and our JAMA Network journals, we have systems in place. We are a very high touch journal. We have both the technology as well as the editors who are really focused on these issues. So I worry less about our journals because we're just hyper focused on it. I worry about the mass of journals that are out there
yes.
because the entire scientific literature doesn't have the luxury of all the great
right.
editors
right.
and all the great technology
that
we do.
All the peer reviewers that you have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But to me, when the quality of everything is poor, it comes back to our journals
uh-huh.
as well. And
yeah.
so I think it is something all of us have to take seriously.
Thank you.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about research, publishing, and the infrastructure. Part of our audience are federally qualified health centers. We've been involved in that movement for over 50 years. And one thing that we saw was that there was a lack of research and publications going on. One thing that Margaret headed up was the formation of the Weizmann Institute, which is really trying to address this issue. For so long, we had the patients, we had the questions, we lacked the methodological tool. Trying to think about how we strengthen the infrastructure at federally qualified health centers.
Yes.
What's the role that JAMA can play, or for the larger research industry to really be partners in helping build this capacity?
Yeah. You're speaking my language. I think that you know, JAMA recently held a summit on clinical trials, and clinical trials are really our highest form of evidence
right.
for what works. But we wring our hands all the time about clinical trials because they don't enroll enough patients, and it's hard to enroll, and they're so inefficient, and they are not pragmatic. They're not done in real world settings. And I think we and they also oftentimes are studying a patient population that is not representative of who the patients ultimately that we are taking care of. There are many ways in which investing in infrastructure in the types of healthcare settings that you're talking about can help to address some of these issues. They're not the entire solution,
yeah.
but just as you're saying, I really feel strongly that
real venues where people are getting care, like federally qualified health centers, patients and communities that are oftentimes excluded from research. If we make it easier, people will participate in research. And that participation in research is in fact part of the trust issue. Right. It is part of that, yes, I'm participating, I know, and yeah. I trust that this is what happens. It's a virtuous cycle when we think about it. But as you say, these are not one-off investments. They're not one-off transactions, or I have this one study, let me go find that federally qualified health center. This is a commitment, has to be, to investing in infrastructure. And so we've been thinking about a lot of the themes that came out here in some of our conversations and we've addressed earlier is like, should the funding for some of the federally qualified health centers be deliberately added for being involved in research? Mm-hmm. Right. We know other countries like the UK, they're very good at conducting research because they give money to the hospitals to be involved in research.
Yeah. That's right.
And if we say we have a commitment to diversifying our study populations, to asking more pragmatic questions of relevance to real world settings, we have to invest in those so that there's sustained infrastructure, not one-off study by study.
And thinking about relevance, I'm listening to a session earlier this morning about gun violence and asking about evidence-based research that might exist there. Is that an area that JAMA has in its horizon of focused in on? And I know, again, these are some of the controversial areas that will come to you as an editor-in-chief that you'll have to make some decisions on.
Yeah, so, you know, early on in my tenure, we did a theme issue on the issue of gun violence. It ends up being when you just say that, people think of it as a polarizing issue. One of the themes that came out in this session is that this is a public health issue.
Right.
And that we at JAMA, this is in our lane because it is a public health issue. And I think the approaches, we will be doing convening a JAMA summit on gun violence.
Oh, great.
But it really will be focused on not the politics, but really what are those things that we need to be doing on a 1 to 5 year time horizon to really shift the impact of gun violence in our communities. And so many themes came out this morning on suicide being one of the main scourges of gun violence, of this really affecting rural communities and older
veterans,
white men, veterans, farmers,
In
addition to the urban violence that oftentimes is what people hear about. But all what we need to do is just take the public health approach to thinking, not the politics, but how clinicians and those who want to think about research and the evidence can address this issue.
Can I get one last question in here about the day in the life of the editor-in-chief?
Yeah.
And also the role that you take on in terms of nurturing the next generation, hopefully of a diverse leadership that will hopefully make changes. But I think people would know the rigor that is required in the work that you do.
Yeah, so thanks. Luckily, this isn't the work of one person. We have a remarkably strong team at the JAMA Network. There are 250 people in Chicago who are devoted to the editorial work and the publishing work of our 13 journals. That doesn't include our academic editors who are dispersed across the country, who lead our other 12 journals. So this is a big team. And as is often the case, the day in the life is, the hard decisions oftentimes will come back to me. The problems will come back to me. But my job is to make sure that we have the right people in those positions who are making and the right processes in place so that we can have confidence in the decisions and how we publish. For me, I have been more doing these interviews, been more out there, mostly because I think that the conversations about trust, about how we communicate during this time, how people get their information, are those things that I want to engage in and I want to engage in with others. you're right that the next generation, we want them to be involved in publishing. We've launched fellowships across all of our journals. We just finished a great inaugural group of junior, they're early career folks who are nurses, PhDs, and physicians who basically came and spent 6 to 12 months with us at JAMA. I want to demystify the idea of what journals do, because we're just one part of a big biomedical ecosystem that we all care about. We all have the same goals. We all do different parts of this to make this all happen. But we all have to understand how the different parts work so that we can achieve some of these, you know, pretty lofty goals that we've been talking about today.
Well, I am sure that there are a lot of young and not so young people here at this conference that are looking to you as a role model. And congratulations on getting that fellowship up and running. And Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, we want to thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare in this beautiful setting here at Aspen Health in Colorado. And to our audience, thank you as always for joining us. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and we'd love to hear from you. Kirsten, thank you again so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.